Well, thank you very much for the introduction and more so for the invitation to be here to honor a scholar whom I didn't know as well as Walt Kaiser did, but whom I have admired through his writings, primarily, of course, the work on keeping all of us up to date as to what's going on in the field of Old Testament biblical theology and the various editions of that work. And I think my appeal would be for somebody, Michael, perhaps you, if you have not skipped out by now. If you have, then I'll catch you. There you are. Michael, you need to appoint somebody to do a fifth edition, I think, somewhere along the line. We need that work very, very badly, and it's a work that really shaped my thinking to a great extent. Now, Walt Kaiser said he was born in 1933, and Gerhard was born in 1935. Guess when I was born? 1934. So I stand between you two guys, trying to keep you straight, keep you from tangling with each other too much. And I also, I think, theologically may stand somewhere between you as well. I'm not a multiplex guy. I'm more of a uniplex guy, I guess, as Walt would be, but with a different plex. But apart from that, we share so much in common. I'm always glad when I'm on the same program with Walt Kaiser, because that means I'm not the oldest guy in the room anymore. Thank you all. Oh, my goodness, we have a great time at these meetings, but I'm going to try to speed it up. What's that, Walt?
As you were.
Yeah, as I were. As it were, yes. Yeah, well, I've been working on a commentary in the Book of Chronicles. You say, who in the world would want to do a commentary in the Book of Chronicles? It's nothing but genealogies. Well, after you've made your way through the first nine chapters, you'll find out there's a lot more to it than that. And pause and think a bit and work on the first nine chapters, and you'll find there's a treasure house of theology there as well. The longest chapter in my forthcoming work is the chapter on the genealogies. Of course, all you got to do is print all the names in those various lists, and you've made quite a lengthy chapter right there. But I did more than that, believe me. And it has been one of the most challenging and blessed experiences I've ever had as an author, is to wade my way through the Book of Chronicles and discover what a remarkable book it is on its own. You know, let me say just another word of personal recognition. I'm honored to be asked to participate in the session in the recognition of the exemplary life, and I know more about it now, Michael, thanks to you. What a man he must have been in the family as well, of Gerhard F. Hassel and the significant contributions he made to a broad range of biblical scholarship. I, with countless others, stand deeply in his debt for informing and instructing me in how to be a man of God and a first-rank scholar. I don't claim I'm there yet, but he's instructed me how to go about it. I hope to arrive at it sometime in the next couple of decades, at which time I'll be 100 years old. He showed us that the two can be combined. And young men and women, I hope you will bear that in mind. You don't have to be an arrogant sort of an individual to be a good scholar. The more arrogant you are, the less scholarship I think you really possess. You may have knowledge, but you don't have a lot of wisdom. Huge difference. Now, the Book of Chronicles, of unknown authorship and uncertain date, is a neglected part of the canon, deemed by some to be either nothing but, well, even Paul said, endless genealogies, 1 Timothy 1:4, or a useless repetition of the history of Israel, already treated at length in Samuel and Kings, the so-called Deuteronomic history. Well, these are false premises, and in effect, they relegate the work to a practical non-canonicity. This paper is an attempt to help restore the book to the position it enjoyed at the hands of the ancient compilers of the canon as an independent treatise on history, and more important, as a motherlode of rich theological treasure. I did a little statistical research here, and the book, The Flowering of Old Testament Theology, has been mentioned before. I hate to say anything negative about it, but I must, in the interest of trying to make a point here in regard to Chronicles. The scripture index of that marvelous volume yields only 8 references to Chronicles, out of about 1,400 in all for the rest of the Old Testament canon. This translates into less than 6/100ths of a percent of the whole, though Chronicles makes up 6% of that part of the Bible. Something wrong with that picture. Now, the trauma of the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, the exile of thousands of Judea citizens, and the return after 70 years to the homeland, and the difficult task of starting the new covenant community virtually from scratch, all of this contributed to a reassessment of Israel's meaning and destiny. The chronicler, theologian, thus composed his work not just as a history of his people from their ancient beginnings, but an interpreted history, one designed to offer hope to the beleaguered community, as well as to issue warnings that should they fall back into the ways of their fathers, they could expect the judgment of God to be repeated. Now, the principal theological themes of the book, in my opinion, are, first, the restoration and rule of the Davidic dynasty. Second, the renewal of the everlasting covenant made with Abraham and affirmed at Sinai. And third, the new temple as a symbol of a reconstituted and reconsecrated people. That Israel remained the special people of Yahweh is clear from the very beginning of the book, the genealogies. These are not just random lists of names and tribal affiliations, but selective witnesses to the faithfulness of Israel's covenant with God. But the comprehensiveness of the lists broadens Yahweh's concern far beyond the little remnant of the post-exilic state of Yehud. Indeed, it opens with the genealogy of Adam, the father of the entire human race, narrows to that of Noah, the second Adam, in effect, and then to Abraham the Hebrew through Eber, and from which we, of course, get the word Ivri, kind of an Eberite, if you please, or a Hebrew, the founder of the covenant people, Isaac his son, and Jacob, whose name changed to Israel, provided the eponym for the later nation itself. Eventually, the lines of all 12 tribes of Israel are traced. However, the listing commences not with Reuben, the eldest, but with an expansive treatment of the offspring of the fourth son, Judah. The chronicler in this way signals that primogeniture is of little significance in the outworking of God's covenant purposes. Now, the precedent for this principle is established early on in the biblical record. Seth replaces Cain and Abel. Shem is selected over his brothers. Isaac edges out Ishmael. Jacob comes before Esau. Moses, not Aaron, leads Israel out of bondage. And now David comes to the fore after 7 other brothers, older brothers, are rejected as suitable candidates for the throne. The same, of course, could be said with respect to Solomon, clearly not the heir apparent, as his order in the sons of the family would seem to dictate. And so this is a rather pervasive theme, as it turns out. Now, Judah's centrality is underscored further in the manner in which all of Jacob's sons are listed at the beginning. And then in detail, first and exclusively, Judah. The whole subsection then points straight to David through Perez, Hezron, and finally to Jesse. It was he who fathered David, the man after God's own heart, which I take incidentally to mean the heart of God and not David's heart. We're never selected because of something good about us. We're selected because God is good. And Samuel and Kings narrate the reign of David with the positives and negatives equally distributed and even emphasized, especially the darker sides. It is true that David is the man after God's heart, but this, as I say, says nothing of his character, but only of his selection for kingship. It's true he slew the giant, but he also took a married woman for a wife and added many others also to his harem. I think he had 18 in all before he was finished, which, of course, his son Solomon exceeded many times over. He showed mercy to Jonathan's son Mephibosheth, but disdained his own son Absalom, who therefore led a nearly successful coup against him. Finally, he committed adultery with Bathsheba, murdered her husband to cover it up, and paid the consequences of this string of misdeeds with unending troubles within his own family. Now, Chronicles minimizes these kinds of episodes, not because they did not happen, but because his concern was the reinstatement of the Davidic dynasty with an idealistic vision quite out of keeping with David's less messianic past. It is true he recounts faithfully the accumulation of wives, but he famously avoids any reference whatsoever to the fate of Bathsheba and Uriah, her husband. Other theologically driven omissions are references to Tamar's rape by her own brother Amnon, Absalom's estrangement from David and the ensuing rebellion, and the troublesome succession to the throne by Solomon. The most egregious recorded act by far was David's sin in taking the census of his troops, for which he deeply repented, but which resulted in God's judgment and then favor. Now, the agenda of the chronicler is clearly to set the stage for an ongoing succession of Davidic kings in fulfillment of God's unconditional covenant pledge. He surely was familiar with the history of promises of an anointed ruler passed down from one generation to the next. The messianic, quote with single quotes, messianic seed was first planted in the Abrahamic covenant, which speaks of his offspring being the means of blessing the whole earth. Genesis 12, 15, 17, etc. Isaac and then Jacob were instructed of this truth and passed it on to their descendants, generation after generation, until the chronicler's own time. He recalled the blessing of Jacob upon Judah that specified that a ruler from that tribe would someday rule over Abraham's seed, Genesis 49, 10. The blessing by the pagan seer Balaam that a star would rise out of Jacob and exercise kingship, Numbers 25. The promise to David that he would be that star, 2 Samuel 7, and David's own assurance of that fact in his and others' poetic responses to it, Psalm 2, 45, 72, 89, and 110 notably. The prophets too spoke of that figure over and over again, linking him with David and his dynasty. Isaiah refers to his everlasting reign, its righteous character, and the mysterious Eliakim, who will inherit David's keys to the kingdom. Jeremiah announces that a branch will sprout from David and reign in the day of God's second Exodus delivery of his people. Elsewhere, the prophet speaks of an unnamed scion of David who will be king, and he promises that the Davidic throne will never be vacant, a promise based on God's irrevocable covenant. Ezekiel adds his word of confirmation of all the prophets who preceded him. He speaks of David as a messianic shepherd who will feed God's people, chapter 34, as a prince who will rule over them, in chapter 37. Hosea appears to link together Yahweh, Israel's God, and David their king, hinting perhaps at a divine messianic offspring, in chapter 3, verse 5. Amos, in a glorious reference to a future David in his tabernacle, sees that it will be rebuilt and become a magnet to attract the nations of the earth to Yahweh. Finally, the post-exilic prophet Zechariah echoes and enlarges upon the theme of Davidic rule in clearly eschatological terms. The house of David, that is, of course, the dynasty, he says, will be, quote, as God, a remarkable metonymy, meaning that the house of David will be indistinguishable from the house of God, because both will be ruled by the David who is yet to come. This will be possible because the same messianic figure will have provided a means whereby the sinful people of the Lord can be purified. Now, speaking of the house of David, the theology of Chronicles, centered as it is on David and his historical and eschatological reign, is founded on and encompassed by the concept of covenant, the instrument by which Yahweh initiated relationship with David, his nation Israel, and indeed all of mankind. Just go all the way back, all right, to Genesis 1. It's inherent in creation itself, the climax of which was God's creation of humankind, quote, to be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and, quote, to have dominion over it. The failure of the first generation to meet these covenant demands resulted in alienation from God and thus the need for a remedy to restore the broken relationship. The problem was twofold, sinfulness and incapacity to serve God as His image, His vice regent, as it were, and thus began a process of redemption and restoration, every stage of which was in terms of a covenant structure in which God took the initiative, outlined the stipulations, and promised to bless or curse depending on the response of the person or persons to whom the covenant was offered. The arbitrary unconditional covenant with Noah in Genesis 6 and again in 9 repeated the mandate to rule and also pledged to him that never again would the earth be destroyed by a flood. It also made provision for one of his sons, Shem, to be specially blessed as a vehicle through whom the nations would be blessed in Genesis 9:25-27. Though neither reigning nor salvation is explicit in the Genesis text, the reference to Eber in the Shem genealogy is a deliberate attempt by the compiler to advance the notion of both by hinting at the ethnicity of the later Abraham, Ivrit, and the narrative comment about Eber embedded in the text. The chronicler is careful to include this, quote, messianic clue in his genealogical table as well, in 1 Chronicles 1:19. For he, like the compiler of the Genesis list, is concerned to highlight Eber as the patronym of the chosen people. The Eberites issued in Abraham, Abram first, of course, then Abraham the Hebrew, a term almost always used by outsiders to describe Abraham and his descendants. There are a few exceptions, of course, although most of the exceptions are in addressing a foreign king. This Shemite, Semite, through whom blessing was promised, now is identified and becomes indeed, by means of another more precise covenant, the conveyor of both Yahweh's salvific purposes and the promise of a dynasty that would represent the sovereignty of Yahweh on the earth. It even made provision for kings who, like mankind in general, would be the surrogates of Yahweh, through whom he would reign. Isaac, too, was blessed with the covenant promise, Genesis 26, as would Jacob, Genesis 27 and 28 and 35, 46. Most particularly because the promise of royal succession came from his own lips in the blessing of his sons. Judah, then, would be the son and tribe whose offspring one day would rule over not just the seed of Abraham, but over, quote, all the people. That David was the epitome of this anticipated ruler is clear from several passages, especially genealogies designed to make that connection. The first of these canonically is Ruth 4:18-22, which traces the line of Perez, a son of Judah, through to David, the tenth in the line inclusively. Not to be overlooked is the fact that David's grandmother was Ruth the Moabite, a harbinger of the inclusion of Gentiles within the covenant, as previous covenant promises had declared. The Deuteronomic history omits any reference to David's genealogical ancestry, which makes the inclusion of such a register in Chronicles one of the hallmarks of its difference from that earlier source. Chronicles chapter 2, commencing with Perez, agrees with Ruth 4, except for the inclusion of other kinsmen more distantly related to David in 2:5-14. Moreover, the chronicler continues the record by listing David's royal descendants all the way to Anani, 1 Chronicles 3:1-24, otherwise unknown. In this manner, the linkage between the dim concepts of a single ruler to come and the full-blown realization of it in the historical figure David was of inestimable value. And by the way, I think Anani must be dated sometime as late as the early part of the 4th century before Christ, perhaps as late as 375. Now, we could debate that all evening, but it's hardly worth debating. Anyway, it's not a huge theological issue. The covenant texts relating to David are found in both 2 Samuel 7 and 1 Chronicles 17. On the surface, it seems the two versions are nearly identical, Chronicles having been a transcription of Samuel. However, a few details of some significance should be noted. First, where Samuel refers to God as Yahweh some 6 times, Chronicles frequently prefers Elohim, the generic for deity. However, Chronicles also makes use of the name Yahweh 3 times, so there's no need to posit a Yahwist or the like. However, where Samuel reports that, quote, Yahweh tells you that Yahweh will make you a house, Chronicles reads, I tell you that Yahweh will make you a house, a somewhat more intimate communication. Also, where Samuel employs a second person pronoun, your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever, your throne shall be established forever, Chronicles uses the first and third persons. I will settle him in my house and in my kingdom forever, and his throne shall be established forever. Of special note is the his house, kingdom, and throne in Samuel, and the my house and kingdom in Chronicles. The most significant difference in the parallel text has to do with the omission in Chronicles, but inclusion in Samuel of the possibility of a royal descendant whose iniquity would result in harsh punishment and the loss of Yahweh's covenant loyalty, his chesed, 2 Samuel 7:14. Chronicles also holds out the possibility of the latter, but is silent about the potential sin that might bring God's harsh judgment in addition. Clearly, the chronicler is painting a more favorable portrait of David, at least here. In both accounts, one thing remains constant, however, and that is the certainty of the endurance of an eternal Davidic reign. Founded upon the promises to that effect of a God who cannot lie, the chronicler's community can be assured of the eventual victorious outcome of the kingdom purposes of God. Included in the chronicler's version of the so-called Davidic covenant, apart from the details just mentioned, are the following elements with identification of those parts that differ from 2 Samuel 5. First, the Samuel narrative points out at the very beginning that David informed Nathan about his plans to build a temple because the surrounding world situation now permitted it. He had rest from all his enemies. In Chronicles, David's impetus is merely the fact that he lived in a grand palace, whereas Yahweh still dwelt in a tent, symbolized by the presence of the ark. In 2 Samuel 7:5, Yahweh asks whether David plans to build the temple. The query in Samuel turns into an imperative. You must not build me a house. Excuse me, I meant the query in Chronicles. You must not build me a house to dwell in. 2 Chronicles 17:4, against LXX, you must not, and so on, in agreement with Chronicles. Now, Chronicles omits the name of the king from whom Yahweh had taken his covenant loyalty, referring to him only as him that was before you. Samuel openly names him as Saul, the one whom I put away from before you. So this house of Saul, house of David thing is played down drastically by the chronicler, who hardly wants to mention his name, although he's forced to because Saul existed and naturally it cannot be entirely overlooked. 4. The guarantee of the future security and endurance of David's dynasty is in the passive voice in 2 Samuel 7:16. Your house and your kingdom will be made sure ad olam, forever, before you. Your throne will be established forever. Chronicles, on the other hand, renders it in the active. I will settle him in my house and in my kingdom forever, and his name, his throne, then we do have the passive, of course, shall be established forever. Each of these observations by itself might seem to be of little moment, but taken together, they yield the following synthesis. The center of Yahweh's attention is clearly on the temple and the establishment of David and his everlasting dynasty as its caretakers. He dismisses the irrelevant reference to peace from enemies, including Saul, converts David's question about building to a divine command to do so, and prays that he, Yahweh, says that he, Yahweh, will personally establish both temple and monarchy forever. They will not be established. He will do the establishing. Now, the prophets add their affirmations of the certainty of all this and its implications for Israel and the nations. Isaiah, announcing the miraculous birth of a son to a virgin, addresses the house of David in this context, suggesting that the birth is somehow connected to that dynasty. More explicit is his proclamation about a royal Davidic throne from which will issue chesed, emet, and mishpat, grace, truth, and righteousness, Isaiah 16. Other clear sentiments of this kind by Isaiah occur in 22:22 and 55:3, the latter adumbrating the covenant promise of 2 Samuel 7:11 through 17, and anticipatory of 1 Chronicles 17. Jeremiah ominously says of Jehoiakim that no one of his seed will sit on David's throne, Jeremiah 22:30. However, the prophet does aver that a throne of David exists and will do so in the future. More explicitly, he speaks of the righteous branch who will reign as a Davidic offspring, executing justice and righteousness and delivering Israel from her enemies. In 33:18-22, Jeremiah assures his hearers that the covenant with David will never be broken and that his descendants will be multiplied. As I compare here, I think the covenant promised to Abraham in Genesis 15:5. Other prophets also lend their voices. Ezekiel, looking to the day of the Lord, declares in the name of Yahweh, I, Yahweh, will be Israel's God and my servant David prince among them. Furthermore, Yahweh will make an everlasting covenant of peace with them. Quote, in the latter days, says Hosea now, the people of Israel will return and seek Yahweh their God and David their king. Zechariah is so bold as to say, quote, the house of David will be as God. We mentioned that text before. And that in that day, Yahweh will pour out upon the house of David the spirit of grace and supplication. In strongly salvific terms, the prophet goes on to iterate, quote, a fountain will be opened to the house of David and the people of Jerusalem for sin and for impurity. Now the restored temple. This is the third and last of the themes. But this is a real long, long theme, as Walt might say, to sort of condition you to what's going to heat up the clock here. Now, a third major theme of Chronicles theology has to do with the temple, God's symbolic dwelling place on the earth. The term or its equivalent occurs about 190 times in the book of Chronicles, primarily, of course, with reference to the so-called Temple of Solomon or First Temple. In 33 of these instances, the focus is on David's preparation for its construction, and 60 others recount the actual building of it and Solomon's theological reflection on it. The rest have to do with the history of the temple in the divided monarchy period until its destruction and the proclamation of Cyrus authorizing its reconstruction, 2 Chronicles 10-36. The concept of an earthly dwelling place for Yahweh has ancient roots in the Old Testament. There is intimation of it at the very beginning when God walked about in the garden, making himself at home, as it were. Then throughout the patriarchal narratives, there are multiplied instances in which God, if not dwelling in any sense, nevertheless touched the earth at various places, making those places holy, and asserting at the same time that he could mingle with human beings. Usually these places were thereafter marked by altars or other structures testifying to God's visitation. Genesis 8:20, 12, 7 and 8, 22, 26, 33, etc. A temporary temple-like dwelling came into being in the Sinai Desert in the days of Moses. The express purpose for the sanctuary, the Mikdash, from Kodesh, of course, was for Yahweh to dwell among them, Exodus 25, 8. He said he would meet them there, especially in the most holy place where sat the Ark of the Covenant, tantamount to his royal throne. From then until the reign of David, the tabernacle seemed adequate. David, however, felt that as a proper and established king, he needed to build a royal palace. But having done that, he was struck by the obvious fact that while he dwelt in royal splendor, Yahweh still lived in temporary quarters that were far too demeaning for the ark and its invisible occupant. Thus, he instigated the construction of a suitable temple for Yahweh, though he left to Solomon the execution of his plans as his final legacy. And oh, the number of chapters in 1 Chronicles devoted to this transition, and especially the injunctions to Solomon to do exactly what God said. God, in fact, lowered the blueprint, as it were, from heaven, so there'd be no question who the architect was and how they were to build it. Just as Yahweh was pleased with the tabernacle, filling it with his fiery presence, so he delighted in the temple, manifesting himself the same way. Solomon's prayer in anticipation of God's act of dwelling on earth and in the building he had erected is rich in temple theology, 2 Chronicles 6, 14 through 42. In line with the great Shema, he extolled Yahweh as the incomparable God who keeps covenant at Hesed, and who has kept all his promises to David about dynastic succession. At the same time, he exults in the temple. Solomon recognizes its inadequacy to contain the great God of the universe. Nonetheless, he fully understands that the city and the temple are indeed in fulfillment of the promise of Deuteronomy 12, 5 and 11, that this would be the place where God would put his name. Even were Israel to sin and be dragged away into exile, he was confident that if they sincerely repented, Yahweh would bring them back and restore to them all they had forfeited. Jehoshaphat understood the significance of the temple as a vital element in Israel's theology. In time of trouble, he said he would stand before the temple recognizing it to be God's house, 2 Chronicles 20. Jehoiada the priest, on the occasion of the coronation of the boy king Joash, led the gathered throngs of people in covenant reaffirmation in front of the temple, recognizing Joash as a true heir of David. Hezekiah's succession to the Davidic throne was marked by refurbishment of the temple, recommitment to the Davidic covenant, and an attempt to include even the depleted populace of the north in reunification with the Davidic south as one people of Yahweh. The chronicler summarizes his account of the good king by observing that he kept Torah and the commandments in line with the injunctions of Deuteronomy. Josiah likewise stands out in the narrative as a worthy occupant of the Davidic throne. He began to seek after Yahweh early in his life, undertaking demolition of pagan worship sites and the restoration of the temple that had fallen into grievous disrepair and cultic impurity. In the course of refurbishing the temple, a scroll of Deuteronomy was found, the reading of which by Josiah impelled him to lead the people in covenant recommitment. Perhaps his greatest legacy is found in the epitaphic summation, quote, now this from Chronicles, all his days they, that is the community of faith, did not depart from following Yahweh, the God of their fathers, end of quote. For the most part, however, the chronicle paints a gloomy picture of neglect of the temple by David's descendants and the nation as a whole. As noted already, the chronicler's account of history ends with the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple and the exile of its last Davidic ruler, followed by what is likely a later appendage that speaks of the liberating decree of Cyrus that enabled restoration of both the Jewish state and the temple. Though the book was without doubt composed at least a century after the return, reflection on the exile and all that had occasioned it, as well as the gloomy and pessimistic post-exilic situation of the people of its composition, provided the landscape against which a new historical and theological account of the people could and must be written. As Sarah Yaffe correctly observes, quote, "The chronicler places himself and his generation in the time of Cyrus. Restoration lies ahead and is about to begin." End of quote. Chronicles must thus be read and understood within this framework. Thank you very much.